Welcome to the Crystal Pain Show, where we help you embrace your life right where you are and give you practical steps to get where you want to go. Whether you are in your car, folding laundry, cooking, cleaning, or maybe even just enjoying a cup of coffee and a few minutes of quiet, we're so glad you're joining us today. Here's your host, wife, mom of six kids, foster mom, entrepreneur, and author, Crystal Pain. Welcome to another episode of the Crystal Pain Show. I am really excited about this episode because I actually read this author's book. I got it in 2022, did not read it until 2024. And I know that I was supposed to read it in 2024 because it just so deeply resonated with my life. And so when I heard that she had a new book coming out, I was so excited that I got to have her on my podcast and we are going to have the best conversation. I already know. Mary Morantz, she has a new book called Underestimated, The Surprisingly Simple Shift to Quit Playing Small, Name the Fear, and Move Forward Anyway. Y'all, I opened up my advanced copy that I got. And I read the first little bit and I just wanted to cry. This is so beautiful. I'm just going to read it to you. This is not the whole thing, but just a little section. She said, "For all those who have ever felt underestimated, first by the world, but even worse by yourself, these words are both a love letter to you and a field guide as we fight our way forward together. More than anything, as we begin, know this. A lifetime of being overlooked has now turned you into someone who sees." Mary, that's powerful.
Oh my gosh. Well, we're just all going to start crying right from the beginning. Crystal, thank you for that beautiful introduction and for pulling that part out, because that tells me that you are someone who, like, regardless of, we were talking a little bit before we jumped on, like, different origin stories, I still believe, like, the beginning of that part is like, here's to the kind ones, the quiet ones, the ones so often overlooked. Pain, like progressively finer grits of sandpaper, has rounded off our hard edges until we are a soft place to land. But at the same time, that muddy story makes us feel someone like you will never be able to get there. Well, you know, we'll never be able to do this thing you're being called up to. And so I feel like it's sort of like that instant recognition of, like, if that line jumps out to you, what that tells me is that you are someone who sees. Mm. And that's kind of the gift of having these things in our stories where I've felt like the underdog my whole life. I've over-identified as being the underdog. And it's like, what are the beautiful counterweights that come out of that? And it's like, I've been overlooked. Mm-hmm. So I never want to make somebody feel that way. So I want to be someone who sees. So right off the bat, we're in a good place.
Yeah. I call myself a double second born because I have an older sister. And so I'm second and second also as a girl. And so if you study birth order, you know that second borns tend to really struggle. They struggle with feeling overlooked. They struggle with feeling overshadowed. And then also I've found that they can either be very quiet or they can be very loud. Yeah. It seems like there's no in between. They're very loud to try to kind of overcompensate for how insecure they feel, or they're just in their shell. And so this just resonated with me so much because I have this older sister who literally is amazing. Like, she can play every single instrument. Wow. I'm not kidding you. She was asked to play an organ at a wedding. She'd never played an organ in her life. And she played this huge, massive pipe organ for the wedding. She learned in 3 weeks. Like, wow. That is my sister. And then my brother underneath me is just always was so far ahead of me when it came to everything academic. And he is now a test pilot. Like, he was the person who, you know, he's doing calculus and I'm over there like trying so hard to like figure out basic algebra, yeah. You know? And so I just always felt like, what's my gift? Mm. You know, where's my gift? Theirs are so obvious and mine just, what is it? And so this journey of figuring out, okay, what does that look like? And how do I stand in confidence of the gifting that God has given me, even though it's maybe quieter or it's maybe different, but it's that thing of, I became a person who sees.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you grew up in a family where, like, excellence was the, like, baseline, right? Like there's this sort of like, we are people who perform at this level or above.
Yes. Yeah. Well, very much it's like, I feel like there was a standard of expectation put on us. I am grateful for my parents expecting us to have very strong character and very strong work ethic and just pushing us really hard. But I think as someone who really struggled academically and just really struggled with that insecurity, there were challenges that came along with that.
So, interesting.
But this is your story, not my story. Sorry,
I'm a podcaster too.
We're getting into this, but I would love for you to just give us a little bit of background on, you know, you said you felt like you were the underdog. Do you still feel like an underdog?
Ooh, okay. We're just going to have therapy right now. Yes is the short answer.
Okay.
It's getting better is the longer answer. Mm-hmm. So for everybody listening, maybe you're meeting me for the first time. I was born and raised, I grew up in a single wide trailer in very rural West Virginia, on the top of a mountain called Fenwick Mountain. And when I say single wide trailer, I really want to kind of paint that picture for a second of like, it was a true 1980s, like single wide is important. That becomes an important part of the story. This was not a really nice double wide with like the nice brick, you know, permanent foundation. It was a tin can. And sort of the thing to do in the 80s when you got a single wide trailer, the upgrade was to kind of build like a lean-to shack of a one-room addition with whatever wood was in the yard, basically all mismatched boards and kind of these like crooked, rusted out nails. And surprising to no one at all, single wide tin can trailers in the 1980s were not built to last. And to be totally fair, being the feral cats that we were, children of the 80s, I did not help this because me and all the neighborhood children would we'd use the porch to kind of like crawl up onto the porch and the lean-to addition and then all the way up onto the top of the trailer in the rain and use it as the world's most painful slip and slide, which is like, I don't know how I'm still sitting with you right now. Like, how did I survive this childhood? But so the roof started to leak. I always kind of say like, my people are the people who know what drywall ceiling looks like right before it gives way in this downpour, this sort of pregnant pause of swollen possibility right before the muddy waters rain down. And, you know, when the ceiling is leaking and caving in, soon the floor is leaking and, well, not leaking, but it's soaked and caving in. And we had this brown shag carpeting with, you know, mud from my dad's logging boots. And we had stray animals who would go inside just as much as they went outside. And so I say, like, you don't know where the brown shag carpeting ended and the dirt began. And that is where I started. My dad's a logger. His dad was a logger, 8 generations deep of loggers. Fast forward a little bit and I go to Yale for law school. And so we're like, we've seen that movie, right? We know that book. And we are familiar with that underdog trope of very humble beginnings and then the Ivy League, or maybe it's like sports stardom. And it can be very tempting to feel like you will walk through your whole life being the underdog because people are underestimating you and sort of like expecting you to fail. But then B, it becomes you don't know who you are unless you're the underdog. People love an underdog story. They root for the underdog. Do you want to know who we don't root for? Successful people who kept it. Mm-hmm. Leaders have a target on their backs. And so that's, you know, we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but that's chapter 14 in the book. This fear of success is, will people still love me if I become a person with more? Mm. And I know that's going to, you know, speak to a lot of the people who follow you as a struggle they have. So yes, I am still dealing with that underdog complex. I still walk into most rooms and expect to be rejected before, you know, I'll reject you before you reject me. But it is unraveling in me. Mm. And it has become very clear to me, much more importantly, that proving other people wrong is not the kind of sustainable fuel source that's going to get us where we need to go, where we're going, where we're headed. This purpose we're being called to, that's not going to be a jet fuel that's sustainable. Mm. And we need something much more renewable we can pull from if we're going to do work that matters. Mm.
Okay, so I have to go back and ask because I don't think you answered this question in your book. Now, I haven't read Dirt, so you probably answer it in your first book, which Dirt is really that tells your story. But okay, so you're in this single wide and you have this childhood and then you go to Yale. Mm-hmm. I need a little bit of story in between there. Mm-hmm. And also my question is, was going to Yale, like, were you trying to prove something by doing that? Like, was mm-hmm. that if I make it into Yale, mm-hmm. then I will have overcome this underdog syndrome?
It's a both and. And the reason I say that is because, and I do talk about this part in DIRT, I actually wasn't even going to apply to Yale or Harvard. So when I was applying, it was like 2002. And so I don't know if they didn't exist yet or I just didn't know about them, but there were not. Now you can get like scholarships that will waive the admissions fees. At the time, I was paying $100 for every single application I sent in. And that's a lot of money when it starts adding up. It's definitely a lot of money when you don't have any money. And so I had sent in about 12 or 13 applications at that point, a lot of really good schools. I had the grades and the LSAT score that, you know, I sort of knew a range to aim for, but I was, you know, I had a friend at the time who was like, you need to send it to Yale and Harvard. And I was like, why don't we just light $100 bills, you know, on fire? Like, that's what's going to happen. And so my friend actually made me sit down and write the one little like 250 word essay that was above and beyond the normal application that the other schools had that Yale required, and paid the check for the admission. And so on the one hand, the both and, on the one side of that is like, I spent my whole life expecting to fail before I even started. Mm-hmm. I almost didn't go to WVU for undergrad because there were 22,000 students there and I come from a town of 2,000. And so I thought I was going to be number 22,001 in the ranking. And I was really honestly like hand to heaven, really thought I was going to fail out. And I was so afraid of failing that I ran into success. And so there's that side of it. I almost missed out on that being my story because I wasn't willing to bet on myself. And had there not been someone who intervened, I would not be sitting here with that story. And then on the other side of the spectrum, I write in DIRT, what if success is where the real trouble began? What if we get everything we ever wanted, only to still find ourselves when we go home and tuck ourselves in the cool cotton sheets with just the darkness settled in, we still feel like a walking, waking imposter? You know, we whisper to this thin, shouting epidermis, what could you possibly still want? You got everything you ever dreamed of. And I talk about walking around Yale that first year, feeling like I had a hole in my heart that was like a root canal the size of a chest wound that I was trying desperately to just, you know, backfill it with gold stars and brand name labels. There's this whole really beautiful part where I talk about buying a J.Crew cardigan and as if that covering was going to, you know, hide the girl in the trailer. And that when the cold air would hit just right, all of those exposed roots would go screaming back into full life. Like it felt like they could see right through me, as if I had, you know, sort of a death becomes her chest wound, the root canal the size of a chest wound. And so that kind of kicked off, 20 years or so of trying to achieve my way into worth and trying to achieve the good life, at least in terms of like the version of what I had like cherry picked from other people. Like, this is what a good life looks like, chasing a moment of arrival, chasing these future versions of me on these mountaintop moments, these illusioned, illuminated mountaintop moments, believing if I could just catch up to them, then I would feel like the person I needed to be to step into these roles, to step into where I was being called. Only they would not wait for me, right? We look at these versions of us we're waiting to become. They smile as superiors, smile at us, and then go on without us. And so I would say that the letting go of feeling that way has been just the last few years / today.
And what, you know, you talked about how you were afraid of failing. Like, why were you afraid of failing?
I genuinely at the time thought that this sounds so silly to say out loud now, but that's why we're here, right? That's why this book exists, is because these things are silly once you actually speak them out and hear them for yourself. I genuinely thought that there was a direct correlation between how small you started and how big you were headed. I'm just going to let that one hang in the air for a second. We all, myself included, we need to hear that. I thought there was a direct correlation between how small you started, the size of the town I came from, the trailer that I was in, the story that was unfolding. We'll probably get into this. My mom left when I was 9. There was a direct correlation. If you start small, you were meant for small. Mm. And so I genuinely thought, you know, Fenwick Mountain, West Virginia, Richwood, West Virginia, in a sea of 22,000 students who are not just from the bigger cities in West Virginia, they also come from New Jersey because it's cheaper out of state than, you know, Rutgers or whatever is in state. I thought like, well, they're definitely more qualified because look at the like resources they came from, the school, the size of the schools they came from. And that's genuinely it. Mm. You know, start small, stay small. Mm.
Okay. So you alluded to your mom. I'm assuming that there have been a lot of emotions, a lot of things that has impacted you. Tell us about that.
Yes, I would say the biggest thing that came out of that, and I, in a lot of ways, this new book, Underestimated, I've been joking, is sort of like the textbook companion to my first book, Dirt, and also Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots, which is my second book, where I will at times, this is not all the book is, but I will at times pull in passages from those two sort of stories of my life kind of books. And it will be like, okay, you know, Professor Mary, like, let us examine what was actually going on here. And so in Dirt, there's this part where I talk about when my mom first left, this became an experiment for me of using perfect as a weapon. Mm. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to be determined to build a life so beautiful, so extraordinary on the outside that it's going to make you sad that you weren't there to see it. And I kind of have this part where I talk about, it's sort of like, I picture like a daisy growing wild in this burnt, scorched earth, this sort of beauty from ashes, where like, sure, you know, you can grow beautiful things in really rocky soil. And yet it's sitting there in the middle of that, you know, these petals sort of wilting in the scorched earth that grew it. And like this idea of like, if we're going to build a beautiful life, is revenge really the most fertile ground to start from? And so you pair those two together. I talk about this in chapter 10 in Underestimated, which I call perfectionism as hiding with better PR. That kind of really digs into all the ways we push people away and hide in plain sight in the name of never getting hurt again. And so you pair my mom leaving and sort of like, I'm going to use perfect to prove her wrong with these illusion illuminated mountaintop versions of me I just talked about, where like, it's one thing to know for somebody else to leave you. It's another thing for you to do it to yourself. And we abandon ourselves in 1,000 different ways, trying to be perfect enough that we can stay safe. Mm. And that's, you know, I really, that chapter sounds light and breezy. There's this one part where, cause like this book is very much like Mary's humor mixed with like, now let's talk about your whole childhood. I say like, not since the Got Milk people has there been an ad campaign that has made something so plain Jane Vanilla seem so sexy and sought after, as hiding in plain sight and calling it this noble thing of, oh, I'm just a perfectionist. Mm. You know, we treat it like an A-plus thing, an overachiever thing. And so, yes, I think I thought I had to become the, in Slow Growth, I call this person the most put together woman in the room, mm-hmm. not because she would ever think about herself that way and not because she would ever want to make somebody else feel small, but because she thinks that's who she has to be just to be invited mm-hmm. into most rooms and welcome at most tables. And that sort of like, I'll put on this, you know, in Underestimated, I call it a bespoke stoic armor, these neon blinking lights camouflage where we paradoxically blend in by forever standing out. Mm. If all you can see are my achievements, you can never get close enough to see my many flaws. So yeah, you know, it's not like you're run of the mill talk about perfectionism. There's some deep wounds we kind of get into there.
Yeah. Well, I feel like perfectionism is this shield that we use, but it also keeps people at a distance. Like there's no way, because we aren't perfect and we know it. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to keep the facade going that we're the most put together woman in the room, we have to hold people at arm's length.
Yes. And that's the like heartbreaking irony of it all, is we're holding people at arm's length. In Slow Growth, I say like shiny is a stiff arm. It's a Heisman pose, right? We're holding people at arm's length. And then at the very same time, heartbroken because we don't feel accepted, chosen, that there's belonging, that we are loved. And so at the end of the first section of chapter 10, I say, it turns out not needing people is a really great way not to have any. Mm. You know, I go through these kind of like hyper-vigilant, self-sufficient, turn self-sabotaging ways that I have learned to be like, I don't want you looking away from me in some sort of sympathy shame on my behalf. Don't feel sorry for me. And while we're at it, unless specifically asked, I don't want to hear your best advice, good practices, good suggestions, or, you know, models that I should follow. They burn in my ears, run down my throat, and taste like condescension. I don't need you worrying about me. Then I'll just have to worry about you worrying about me. And so it's like, I'm going to become so perfect, so strong, so stoic, so I have it together that I never need people. And then we just wake up one day really heartbroken because we find ourselves alone.
Mm. Yeah. And it takes a lot of risk and vulnerability and this it feels unsafe to need people. That's the thing. Yeah. Like, that's been my journey the last few years of allowing myself to need people, because I realized that I'm always the helper, never the helped.
Yes.
Because I don't want, if I let people in to help me, that shows so much vulnerability. I have to let down a huge guard, mm-hmm. and I have to show that I'm not the most put together. And I feel like God's just done different things in my life to just get me to the place where it's like, nope, you can't, like, that's not working for you anymore. Yeah. And then you have to let people in. And it is this, it's very scary. Mm-hmm. It's very, very scary.
Yeah.
And yet it's this beautiful place to be of you let them in and they still love you.
Yeah. Yes. In slow growth, I talk about at a certain point, we become the girl or the woman or the one who always comes through. Mm. And the underlying fear behind all the others is, what if I don't? You know, we hear that, oh, you've got this. Of course you do. You'll come through. You'll pull it off. You always do. And it's like, but what if I don't? Will you still love me if I don't? I was at a conference very recently and they put up these really beautiful boards in the lobby. And one of the boards said how I can help. And then the other side said what I need help with. Mm. And at the end of the conference, the how I can help was full. Mm. And there were only two little sticky notes on the I need help. And I think like the conference organizer put them up. And they were like, look how giving this community is. And it was like 100%. And also, we really struggle with being the ones who need the help. Mm. I personally hate it. You know, I'm not a big fan of that. But you're also 100% right of like, we were not meant to do this alone. And if you are going to do truly great things, you're going to need other people to come alongside you. Mm. And that's very uncomfortable for those of us who something in our story told us it's not safe to trust anyone, including ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I also feel like for me, acknowledging I need help makes me kind of feel like I failed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that fear of failure. In your book, you talk about show up and start to build something that might actually help people. Show up into the work you were most created to do. You better expect fear to arrive in full force, teeth bared and snarling. But then you talk about how the easiest way to fight back fear is to flip the script. Mm-hmm. So saying, wow, I must really care about this thing if I feel this afraid. And I was just thinking this idea of flipping the script, we could use it in so many different areas of our life. Like when we feel these things coming on, like for me, flipping the script on stress. So when I start to feel stressed, mm-hmm. that actually for me is a red flag of I'm trying to micromanage.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Maybe your child's struggling with a specific subject, or you feel like they just need extra help with their homework and you don't feel qualified to help them out. Or they're asking questions, or you just feel like in school, they're not just really at the pace that you would like for them to be, or maybe they're not being challenged enough in their class. IXL is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies, and it's designed to help kids really understand and master topics in a fun way with positive feedback. Silas used IXL in his math class, and he loved the data points that it gave him, and he loved how he was able to work ahead, and it just really motivated him in math and is someone who really loves to see, you know, exactly where he is and all of the percentages and all of that. It was perfect for him. This program will improve your kids' grades. It will work for any of your kids because it's powered by advanced algorithms, so it gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And you can save time because one subscription gets you everything. You can use it for kids from pre-K to 12th grade. And a single hour of tutoring costs more than a month of IXL, so it can save you money. 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. use IXL. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Crystal Payne Show listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. As a Christian, sometimes it can feel like we rush past the meaning of Easter. There's so much to do. There are so many decisions to be made. There's so much going on in our lives that we forget The meaning of Easter is that God made himself man and died for us so that we could have close access to God just as we are, no matter who we are. And this changes everything. And that's what I want to tell you about the Glorify. And that's why I want to tell you about the Glorify app and Glorify's Holy Week Challenge. Glorify is the number one Christian daily devotional app. And it is such a great go-to if you are wanting to prioritize time in God's Word, daily devotional, scripture, starting your day from that mindset of just remembering the truth of who God is. You can journal your prayers, reflect with guided meditations. You can even explore courses designed to deepen your understanding of scripture and help you grow in your faith. And they have an 8-day Holy Week challenge that it actually guides you through powerful daily devotions, scripture readings, and teachings to help draw you closer to the heart of Jesus. It's 8 days, 8 devotionals. It's that easy. If you're ready to celebrate Easter in a new way, join me and join Glorify's Holy Week Challenge. You'll also get access to exclusive reflections and insights from The Chosen's Laura Silva, guiding you through the season of renewal. Visit glorify-app.com/crystal right now to download the Glorify app for free. That's glorify-app.com/crystal to download the Glorify app for free. glorify-app.com/crystal. Do you feel like you spend so much of your time figuring out what to wear, standing in your closet, looking at all your clothing items and thinking, what am I going to wear today? Or maybe you have a big event or something where you want to dress professionally coming up and you're like, what am I going to wear? Well, Armoire is a great option to help you uncover your personal style. It's a clothing rental membership and you'll have access to high quality, unique brands tailored just for you. That's right. You take a 5-minute style quiz when you sign up and you choose items from your dynamic personalized closet and have them delivered to your door in as little as 2 days. And get this, when you're ready for something new, just swap them out for new to you styles. No laundry required. I have gotten to try Armoire out and I have to tell you, so not only did my personal style quiz kind of bring up some clothes that they recommended that weren't things I would typically choose, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to try this out. And I ended up falling in love with a few of the pieces so much so that when I went to send them back, I'm like, I've worn these so much, I'm going to buy them. And so I did. And I've worn them so much since then as well. I also love that you no longer have to feel badly about if you're just wearing an item once. Let's say you have a big event and you want to buy a nice dress for it. Well, instead of buying it, you could rent it and then you don't have to feel badly if you only wear it once because then you send it back and then you can get something else for another event. It's also great if your body is changing because you're on a fitness journey or during pregnancy, you're not then buying clothes that are not going to fit you for very long. Right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/crystal. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/crystal to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
Manage my life. And to recognize where do I need to let go of control instead of being like, I'm just so stressed and everything, you know, being like, oh, my body is giving me a red flag to tell me that I am trying to micromanage. And so I love this because it's like you're fighting back fear by saying, I care about this, I care about this so much.
Yeah. So some of the least real deal people I've ever met, if I can be honest with you, do not act like they are afraid at all. And it's like, why would they be? Like they're doing a book report on what somebody else said, you know, they're just slapping some ideas together. I was in a whole previous industry before this one of photography. And my husband and I will often joke that like, especially when you start to move into like the creative education space, it's like one of the most uncreative groups of people because they're just sort of like taking other people's ideas. And so like, you know, when there's this, I didn't bleed on the page for original work I'm proud of. I don't actually care if it helps people. I'm not worried about whether it makes good on the promise transformation, whether there's depth and excellence and like, we're not just, you know, slapping slogans, Nike style, just do it. It's going to be fine. On our recommendations, like if you have not poured your heart and soul into something, why would you be afraid? Right? But if you are somebody who you actually care whether it's going to see people and meet people and whether their lives will be different on the other side of having encountered you, then yeah, there's plenty to be afraid of, right? And so that's kind of based on this idea. When these two dots connected in my head when I was writing this, it's like the moment every writer lives for. It's this high of two dots connecting in a way you've never quite seen them connected before. And it's this idea of like, what if fear attacks creatives in particular because it is jealous that it itself is not creative at all? Short of being imbued with two gifts, it can throw its voice to sound like you, because if it sounded like Morgan Freeman, you could catch it every time. And being this shapeshifter where it can change faces so quickly and easily, so you never know which enemy you're really battling. Short of that, it is not tethered to muse or melody or the force of all creation. It is not a very creative guy. It uses kind of the same boring 12 scripts on all of us. It's all been done. It's all been done better. It's all been done by somebody the world actually wants to listen to. I can't start until it's perfect. I can't start until I'm perfect. What if I start and the critics come? What if they say, who does she think she is? What if I start and I don't have the blueprint? What if I don't know every single step in the staircase? What if my voice doesn't really matter? What if I don't really matter? What if it's already too late? And so as soon as we start to recognize that fear in the thousands of years, because if you can go back to the Bible, you see the same kinds of scripts being used then. Fear has not evolved very much. Then we start to kind of be like, cool, I just have sort of like a flip book, like a Facebook back when that was like a real thing. I'm old enough that I actually had an actual Facebook in law school. It was a printed catalog of people who were in your class. Wow. And anyway, like you can flip through and you know those faces. And it's like, oh, cool. You're just the research riptide. You're just the Edward Scissorhands problem. Oh, you're the princess and the pea problem. The Oliver Twist problem, whatever. All these names I give the different faces of fear in the book. The sooner that we can name it, the sooner it sort of loses all of its power. And so I say that, you know, fear's not a very creative guy, but he is a busy guy. And like any good productive overachiever, he has learned how to prioritize. So if you're already playing small, if you're already hiding in plain sight, fear's not going to bother with you very much. A little fear, maintenance mode, perfectionism, self-sabotage sprinkled in, you're good to go. Show up and actually do the work that matters. And now you're level one threat to fear. Now this real face of fear shows up, which is the teeth bared and snarling. He's not just this friendly, light perfectionist guy saying, oh, wait till it's a little better. He's actually the villain. At times he is the helper and we go into like depth with that, with like the inner critic. But, you know, he really will come for you. I've never been attacked more in my entire life than when I'm launching books. And I'm not even talking about the launch. Like our car will break down. Two book launches, our car has died. My Facebook account will get hacked. Two different launches. My Facebook account gets hacked. My husband gets food poisoning. Our dogs get sick, whatever. And so, you know, fear is going to start to play really dirty. And we can actually use that, right? We can say how unoriginal, how uncreative, how limited you are in your repertoire, how predictable fear is. We can actually use that to predict we're on the right track. You know, I would say fear just showed up in full force. Good. You're about to do work that matters. It would not bother you if you weren't. And so that flip of the script is really important to me because it's like the people who worry about whether they'll make this thing all about them, whether they'll become prideful about it. They worry about whether it won't help enough people or be helpful enough to them. Those are not the people I worry about because the fact that they already care. Right? I know they're going to do the work to get there. And so, yes, if we can just say to ourselves, good, we are the kind of tender hearts who actually care about what we put into the world, then it just sort of makes fear this like indicator of, great, we're doing the right thing. Every single time I'm doing the most important work of my life, fear gets really loud and I just go, cool. I was worried that I wasn't doing the right thing, but fear showed up. So like, amazing. We're on the right track. You know,
it makes me think this is totally not about... It's a different kind of work putting into the world, but one of the scariest nights for me of my entire life was the night that they dropped off a little boy who was almost 8 months old, super, super tiny, could barely lift up his head in 0 to 3 month clothes, super malnourished, and gave me the feeding tube, all these boxes of medicines, and we're like, we don't even know who his doctors are. He got dropped off at the foster care office, and we'll try to give you some help in the morning. And I had a book launching a few days later, by the way.
Wow.
I was supposed to go and be at like the Dave Ramsey studio, do this like whole video interview the next morning. And it's just, you know, it was funny because I'd never correlated that with like my book interview. But the scariest thing for me that night, I brought the bassinet down. I had him laying in there and I was like, God, I can't do this. Like, this is too scary. This is too big. Like, this is way beyond what I am capable of. And I couldn't sleep. I was just panicking. And yet I look back and see how stepping into that fear, like saying yes, which is like one of the hardest yeses I've said in my life, has turned out to be the best yes I ever said in my life. Because now I have 4-year-old David, who is like the most amazing, sweetest child who's turned my world upside down and wrecked it in the most beautiful ways. But like, it would have been so easy to just be like, I can't do this. Like, this is too much for me. Mm. But yet in that space of fear, there was also this stretching, and I built so many muscles through that, that now when hard things come, I can look back to that. And I can think those first 4 weeks when we didn't know how we were going to do this. And there were so many doctor's appointments and it was big surgery and all this stuff. It's so far outside of our comfort zone. And yet we did it, and God was faithful to us through it. And now it's like some hard thing comes and I'm like, I did that. God was faithful through that. I can do this too, you know? And I feel like that's the thing for me. Like, when you step into that fear and let yourself actually just face it and walk through it, it gives you courage muscles for the next time around.
100%. And that's science. That's actually science. What you are describing is how our brains work. Like, from a scientific, legit, this is how we're wired standpoint. It's called Bayesian brain theory. It's more commonly called predictive brain theory. Mm-hmm. Talk about this in chapter 7, overthinking is an orange safety cone. All of this chapter titles, by the way, have really fun
I noticed names. That.
Chapter 11,
it.
Failures of bankrupt identity. and so yes, Bayesian brain theory, predictive brain theory says that your brain is an incredible prediction machine. Like, take this thing to Vegas. It's going to give you really good odds. You know, it's going to know pretty accurately, or at least it believes it knows really accurately how well you will do in a thing before you even start. And it's using all of the previous data, and it will continue to update its predictions based on new inputs. But if you are somebody, so basically what it's going to do is it's like, oh, I want to write a book. Oh gosh, that seems really daunting. I don't know all the steps. I don't have the blueprint. It seems too hard. Your brain's going to go, nope, just kidding. We predict we will not do that well. Let's go do something we've done before a million times. Check mark on the list, little gold star, little hit of dopamine. Let's just stick with what you're good at, kids. Mm-hmm. Stick with the quick, easy win. And ironically, like you're talking about of building, putting in our reps, building the muscle memory, the more we start with like small, hard things and then bigger and bigger and bigger hard things, we're creating evidence to the contrary for our brains so that we're literally giving it the new inputs of data that say, oh, wait, we did try that hard thing and it worked out. Interesting. Updating model. And the more we do it, the more we become people who do hard things. And our brains will adjust accordingly. And they will, it's called the amygdala hijack. It will stop hijacking you before you even get started. That is that part of your brain. Literally, when we say we think we're going to fail before we even start, that is that part of our brain that's doing that for us. Because, you know, like what psychologists will tell us is your brain wants you to survive, not thrive. Mm-hmm. So what you're describing is 100% science.
So we need to be doing hard things.
We need to be doing hard things every day. I'm terrified every day of my life right now. I'm terrified right now. I was saying before we hopped on, I am so sweaty. But it's like you actually over time develop a comfort level with feeling uncomfortable. And, you know, I talk about in chapter 3, self-sabotage is a shot glass. We return to chaos because somewhere like a bad geometry proof gone awry, we told ourselves, chaos is familiar. Familiar feels comfortable. Somewhere along the line, we equated comfortable equals safe. So therefore, chaos equals safe. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why we keep returning. For those of us who had unstable home environments, we continue to do things we want to break free of simply because familiar equals safe. Chaos equals safe. And so same kind of thing, like the more we can break that cycle just from like showing up and doing hard things, that becomes our new normal, our new safe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's so much more in this book. There's so much more. I feel like every page you have these quotes, you have these, I was telling you earlier that you just, as people have picked up on, you're a beautiful weaver of words. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like God has just given you this powerful gift to weave words together. And I look at it and I'm like, I'm never going to be that, you know, but at the same time, I can be inspired by you. You know, and I think that that's the thing that's changed for me. Instead of looking at you and reading this book and being like, I'm not enough to be writing a book. Because for years, I would read these books from people who just had the gift that you have of just weaving these
phrase this together. I'm like, where do they come up with that? Yes. But to recognize that's a gift that God has given you, and you are choosing to use it really well. And I'm so grateful, but also to own the gifts that God has given me, which is taking big picture ideas, breaking them down into really practical bite-sized pieces. And I'm not a weaver of words, but I am a provider of solutions, you know?
Love that.
And so to recognize and to own that, there's a gift to stand in the gifts that God has given you, and to be okay with, he's given her completely different gifts, and I'm so proud of her, and I'm so inspired by her, and I can learn from her, but I don't have to be her.
Yeah, I love that. And I just to like flip that mirror right around, like I see in you a gift of community, a gift of showing up. Like I think for people who are able to show up like that so consistently, chapter 13, distraction is a clocking tick, is all about how a ticking clock.
I knew what you meant.
There we go. And it's all about how consistency compounds over time. Like that even that courage to show up and like show your face and speak to your people and do life with them. Like that's a rarity. I know it doesn't feel like it in a world where there's like content, but you're not just showing up as like this clanging gong or cymbal. Like you're showing up and you're doing life with your people and you're leading a team. And you, like you said, you are like, I mean, the ripple effects of like financial households and what that will do to the next gen, the little Marys that are out there, you know, like what if my parents had followed you on Instagram, you know? Wow. And like the giants that they will get to stand on the shoulders of, that gives me chills. And so I very much see that in you, and I wish I had that gifting. So look at us just hanging out and loving each other and being inspired.
Like, it's so good to be at that place where you can acknowledge it and honor the gifts in others. There's so much more that I could ask you, Mary. I feel like my brain is just exploding with all of these questions because this book has such richness and depth to it. But I know that you have a few free resources for my audience if they want to dive more into this.
Yeah, I actually have two places I will point everybody listening. The first is that in Slow Growth is where I actually introduce these characters for the first time, but they carry over into Underestimated. I call them the five achiever types. We've kind of referenced one of them. That's that illusionist in the distance waiting for all the conditions to begin and they themselves to be perfect before they can start. And so the five achiever types are the performer, always on their toes, needs to show both themselves, but also other people how far they've come. I am the classic performer. We have our tightrope walker who could care less who else is clapping, but they need higher and higher death-defying feats to feel the same amount of good. We have our masquerader who shoves other people into the spotlight so that they can kind of razzle-dazzle, sleight of hand, look over here, hide in plain sight. We have our contortionist, who's the classic people pleaser. They contort because it is easier than to be criticized. And we have our illusionist in the distance, who waits for all the conditions to begin and they themselves to be perfect before they can even start. And so if you go to achieverquiz.com, we have put together a really fun quiz. It takes 2 minutes to take, 10 minutes if you overthink it. The questions are super easy and lighthearted. And then in true Mary fashion, we go deep with the results. And so it's going to tell you how each of your, based on your achiever type, you get where you play small, how you get tripped up, and how you stop doing that and move forward from here. So that is achieverquiz.com. And then if you go to namethefear.com, which is the site for the book, we actually, Crystal, have up for your people the entire first chapter free. They can download it and start reading right away, get a feel for my writing. A friend of mine said it's like a 74,000 word Taylor Swift lyric. So you can kind of get a feel for that and just sort of how I talk about really hard things and weave that together. And while you're there, if you want to, the best way to support an author that you have maybe just, you know, connected with and you really like what they stand for, a new book, the single best way to support them is a pre-order. And so if you pre-order, we actually have where you will get the entire audiobook for free. You get the first three chapters, so you can start reading those right away, but you also get the whole audiobook. And I read it. So if you've enjoyed, you know, the last hour, you're going to love the audiobook. I do all the voices for the movie quotes. And so you can check that out. And it's sort of like getting two books for the price of one. So you can have one to highlight and underline, and one where I will whisper to you sweet nothings about how to quit playing small. So that's at namethefear.com. And then I'm at Mary Morantz on Instagram. Tell me what your achiever type is. Tell me if you checked out the book. Tell me if you liked the episode. I want to know, Crystal, what your achiever type is.
I
I think I took the quiz, but I need to take it again because I do not remember. So maybe that tells a lot about me if I don't remember my achiever type.
You weren't ready for it. You weren't ready to hear it.
Okay. So go to achieverquiz.com and to take the quiz and let me know also what achiever type you are. And I'm going to take that quiz so I can let y'all know. And then namethefear.com. I love that you get the audiobook for free.
Me too. That's such a gift from my publisher. I know that's not very common. And I spent, a full week in the studio recording it. And I'm just like, it's fun because I put the emphasis on the wordplay. So if you might have just read past it really fast, you're going to catch a lot of Easter eggs.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So there's all sorts of levels of depth, even more if you listen to the audiobook. That's right. And I know so many people are auditory versus, visual. Or the thing that I love is if you are both, where you can listen and read at the same time. So go to namethefear.com, get that. And I'm just so grateful for all the wisdom that you are putting out to the world, how you are showing up, even when it is hard. Mm-hmm. You are showing up when you felt underestimated. Yeah. And sometimes you still feel underestimated, I'm sure. You still have those fears and you still can feel like the underdog, but you're choosing to push past that fear and keep showing up. And it is just such a gift to the world. So get yourself a copy of Underestimated, The Surprisingly Simple Shift to Quit Playing Small, Name the Fear, and Move Forward Anyway by Mary Morantz. And then go follow her on Instagram and you will be so blessed and encouraged. I have to tell you that everything that she does is done with such beauty and excellence. And even if you don't read what she writes, you're just going to love the aesthetics of it, but also read what she writes. Cause it's like this powerful combination of really beautiful aesthetics with powerfully woven words that really pack a punch. And I'm just so grateful for you continuing to show up in the world.
Thank you. That just made my whole life. And this has been an absolute honor. And I'm just so thankful for who you are and for having me here. And I think you're wonderful and you have a new fan for life.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for joining us today. For more great resources, please visit crystalpayne.com.